Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Lots of chaos following the latest executive orders issued by the White House. We hear from Congressman Ed Case today as things seem to change by the hour. We check in with Aloha United Way, whose social service partner agencies are scrambling to understand how their operations could be affected. We also check in on the energy front, new developments during a contentious time for climate mitigation. For today's Mono Minute, we learn how the peacock's marvelous plumage came to be, and we talk about concussions in sports, what high school football teams are looking at to prevent them in the first place, and why some players are being asked to take their helmets off. It's Wednesday, January 29th, the first day of the Lunar New Year. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week is off to a rough start as President Donald Trump's executive orders have triggered a wave of uncertainty and chaos. It appears that day to day and almost hour by hour, new questions are being raised about what is being affected by these potentially far-reaching policies. The order pausing all federal loans and grants appears to be rescinded, as there is confusion on so many fronts. This morning, Democratic Congressman Ed Case joins us live to discuss this craziness. Good morning.
Good morning. Aloha.
Yeah, welcome.
Kongi Fatjoy.
Yes, Kongi Fatjoy, and welcome back home.
Thank you. It's good to be home out of that confusion and chaos of D.C. for this week, at least.
Yeah, lots of hand-wringing, because yesterday was scary for so many agencies that rely on federal funding.
Well, let's get down to what actually happened. The president, of course, has signed about 30 executive orders at this point in a lot of different areas, and there are, to be honest, pretty much all confusing in some way, shape, or form. So, we always expected that this presidency was going to be a confusing and chaotic presidency, and here we are. We're in this presidency. The order that he issued on Monday was by far the most expansive and the most problematic, because what it basically said was that virtually all federal funding was going to be suspended. He called it a suspension. That just completely disrupted, of course, tens of millions of actual lives out there. So we're not just talking about governments getting money or not. We're not talking about the Hawaii state government, the city and county of Honolulu, anywhere else. We're talking about actual, you know, federal funds that go to bettering people's lives and that people depend on. Yesterday, the Medicaid portal, which serves hundreds of thousands of people here in Hawaii, was closed off, wreaking havoc in terms of all of those who can't get health care anywhere else. Whole aspects of our state and county government, nonprofits that do incredible work in our communities. And that's what the consequence of that executive order was. Now, fundamentally, on that executive order, it's illegal. And the reason it is illegal is very, very straightforward. That money was already appropriated by Congress, passed by Congress. So it passed Congress. It was signed into law by a president, and it is the law of this country that it shall be spent. And the president doesn't like that and wants to restrict it, and in the effort to gain total control, of course, of the federal government, wants to not follow that law. This is called impoundment. It's been around for a long time. We have laws even against impoundment itself, which we shouldn't need laws to say you can't break laws, but we do. So this is just a blatant disregard for the law. Other of his executive orders are within his power, so he hasn't broken the law per se on all of them. I may disagree with most of them on policy, but you know, he's within his rights. Not all of them, but most of them. But this one was just straight out illegal. And of course, a court suspended it immediately. This morning, the president rescinded it. The immediate, threat has passed. But obviously, this is part of a much broader impact or effort to.
Yeah. And it's unclear what happened with that portal, for Medicare. But you know.
It's very, very hard. That wasn't the only portal that was closed for federal funding. So it's not just Medicaid. I talked yesterday with the state attorney general, Ms. Lopez, and her team, and they had specific portals that were closed to them in terms of funding coming into their department. We've inventoried pretty much the entirety of the state government at this point, all of the departments, to understand what the exact consequences were for them. There was confusion all around. This was unnecessary, not to mention illegal. There was a procedure for us to go through if a president disagrees with already appropriated, already legal federal spending. And so one thing that just make sure that we emphasize here is that as we have a debate about the overall amount and scope and conditions of federal funding, that's fair game. I mean, President Trump obviously came in with the vote of a lot of people that felt that the federal government was in some ways overreaching, spending too much. I think it is high time for us to have a big picture discussion on those issues myself, because I'm very, very concerned about our overall federal debt and deficit, which is crippling right now. But this money is not part of that debate. This money was already appropriated, already law. So, hey, let's have that debate, but let's not break the law along the way.
Yes, and, I had a situation this morning where I was calling around some federal agencies and was told, well, we're not sure if we can talk to you. There's something about the external communications with federal agencies.
Well, that's one of the executive orders, which is that mid-level people in federal agencies can no longer talk. They've been instructed not to talk to me in some cases, member of Congress, unless it goes up to the very, very top. So there's clearly an attempt to centralize all discussions and to very carefully control. And I don't blame them for that. I mean, if they think that there's somehow inconsistent messages going off and they want to try to make sure everybody's on the same page, that's fine. But we, on a daily basis, interact with the federal agencies, especially in our constituent services, where we're calling the Veterans Administration all the time. We're calling Social Security. We're calling the IRS. We're calling any number of federal agencies to help our constituents. These are routine inquiries. They
right.
shouldn't be impacted.
But, you know, when I'm thinking of what we're dealing with here, you know, Red Hill and, you know, the EPA and, you know, the University of Hawaii, which interfaces with, you know, DOD and the Energy Department with all their millions in research dollars. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's going to be confusing and chaotic, back to the very basic point, and we're all going to have to work through this. And fundamentally, when you get to really to the bottom of all of this, if you take a look at the president's initial executive orders, probably one of the most concerning to me is the basic firing of the inspectors general in the various departments. And this is kind of an arcane part of our federal government that most people don't really focus on, but the inspectors general were and are set up to control and to review independently the actions of our federal departments and agencies for fraud, for abuse, for illegal activities, for just outright negligence.
Yes, yeah, there are watchdogs.
And there are watchdogs. And to pick a very perfect example of this close to home, our congressional delegation asked the Department of Defense for an inspector general, DOD inspector general review of Red Hill. And the inspector general did an independent review, came back with a very, very full and very, very honest assessment of what went wrong and why and how we can make sure it doesn't happen again.
And that's the value of the inspector general.
Now, President Trump fired the DOD inspector general. So this is obviously an effort to eliminate any, you know, dissent either within the federal administration and certainly in Congress. And so the real question here is, as President Trump pursues an agenda that some parts of it I agree with, some parts of it I don't. But is there going to be a reasonable check and balance on him?
Okay. We are talking to Democratic Congressman Ed Case live in our studios, and we're going to have to take a short break. But stick around. We'll be right back.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
HPR celebrates the life of our former president and general manager and my dear friend, Jose Fajardo. Join me, Ray Cruz, for a special two-hour Latin Beat tribute. Get ready to dance and have fun. It's what Jose would have wanted. Join me Friday evening at 8 p.m. here on HPR 1. See you then.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Let's return to our conversation with Representative Ed Case. He joins us live here in our studio this morning. So, you know, there's a lot going on in D.C. I know our senators are busy with the nomination hearings. What's your take on what's happening there?
Well, I don't have a direct role, of course, in the nominations and confirmations because that's a Senate responsibility, but I obviously have my thoughts. You know, some of President Trump's nominations would be fine with me if I was a senator. I would feel that was within his purview and it was reasonable to vote for them, and so I would have voted for them. But two of the most problematic ones, from my perspective, are up this week. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Department of Health and Human Services. There are things I like about Kennedy's approach, for example, trying to get Big Pharma out of micromanaging and monopolizing drug prices. I absolutely do not agree with his stance on vaccines. It's contrary to the predominance of science. And I think he's just taken a contrary position that is scary for Health and Human Services. So I would vote for that one. But one that concerns me far more is Ms. Gabbard's nomination as Director of National Intelligence, essentially our chief intelligence person in this country, and I think that's a direct threat to national security for a number of reasons. I mean, prior stated positions that are inconsistent with our national security, basic levels of trust, you're talking about somebody that has possession of our absolute top national secrets that are highly compartmentalized. Hardly anybody knows what's going on, and I don't think that she can be trusted with those. I don't think that other countries would trust us with their secrets if she was in charge. I certainly think that there would be widespread morale problems throughout a very competent intelligence community that doesn't need to be dragged through the coals, is doing a good job. And so I hope the Senate rejects that one.
Yes, and we know the governor is there, planning to testify as well. I think there were some follow-up questions he said that they had for him. And our senators have come out, our Hawaii delegation has, essentially. But I don't know. You're back in town just for this week. There's still the business of the people to do.
Well, exactly. And I can spend every waking hour, gyrating around what the president does or doesn't do. And of course, I have to know what he's doing and act in my constitutional obligation as a separate, independent, and co-equal branch of government. My job is not to do what the president wants or to not do what the president wants. My job is to be a member of Congress and act independently to try to do what I can do with my colleagues for the betterment of the country, to support the president where I can, but to be the loyal opposition where I can't, and to act as a check and balance where I have to, and I'm going to do that. And we have a whole range of ongoing issues in Congress, ranging from the normal appropriations process. I'm starting my seventh year on appropriations now. I carry major responsibility, especially in defense and in the homeland security space. I've got to get through a normal yearly appropriations process. I am continue to be very focused on the Indo-Pacific. I continue definitely to be focused on the cost of living here in Hawaii. These are challenges and opportunities also that occur regardless of who's president. And so I've got to continue with my regular business and not get thrown off of stride. As part of that, I need to stay in touch back home, and that's one of my major issues, my major goals this week. I'm running a 6 straight community meeting, talk stories in person, talk stories across my district. I've already had 2 of them. I've got Mililani tonight at Mililani High School, 6:30. I've got Eva Kapolei at Honouliuli Middle School on Thursday, Friday, Washington Middle School in Central Honolulu, and then Saturday morning, Aina Haina. This is all on my website, by the way. I welcome people to come out, but I need to stay grounded with my constituents, my community, my kuleana, my direct kuleana, because, first of all, they need to know what's going on in Washington and why and what I'm up to, and second, I need to listen to them because I need this, Bob already said it, grounding as I go back into that crazy world that is Washington, D.C. right now.
Well, is there anything you can do to help? I mean, you know, we're in the throes of where to site a new landfill, and that may just seem like, oh, well. But, you know, there are efforts that have been underway, you know, that the city has asked the military, you know, is there any land that might work for us that you would be willing to give up? But I don't know.
I got asked this at my community meeting in Pearl City a couple of nights ago, and I said, hey, I got plenty to worry about other than getting into the middle of where landfills are going to be located in Hawaii, and I'm going to leave that part of it to the mayor and to the city council. You know, the military was cooperative in terms of some potential sites. One of the potential sites down near Pearl Harbor was seriously right. considered by the military. They eventually decided that it was very difficult for a lot of different reasons, including direct national security. I'm sure that some of their other lands were considered, and the military does want to be a good partner and to, you know, forge kind of the next generation of military presence in Hawaii in a way that will be totally beneficial to both sides. And so, you know, if it turns out that the landfill discussion is part of that again, fine. But I think it is part of it already. And I presume that the folks at the city and county have picked the best site they think they can get for a lot of different reasons, including accessibility, et cetera.
Yeah. What about affordability? I mean, that's a big concern for everybody as we see people.
National issues impacting us still. We do have inflation down from 8% a couple of years ago to, you know, 4% now, closer to, you know, the high twos into about 3%. So that's good. We've got to stay on track on that. I'm very worried about some of the initiatives of the Trump administration would be highly inflationary. And so we can blow this again by making the wrong policy decisions at the national level, and I'm going to do my part to make sure that that doesn't happen. Here in Hawaii, there's very specific areas that I'm focused on. I'm back to the Jones Act, which always been a great concern to me because it adds a 10 to 15, 20% in some cases premium onto shipping that is passed on to the consumers. That shouldn't be necessary. I'm also pursuing a legislative proposal with my colleagues in the other island and non-contiguous parts of our country, which is basically saying to the major retailers out there, it's not fair for you to charge a shipping fee on your stuff when you go online to get it to Hawaii if you're not doing that to everybody. And furthermore, you shouldn't be saying that it's free shipping and then we go on and go all the way through the process at the end and say, oh, by the way, we don't ship to Hawaii.
Right.
So fundamentally, that adds to the cost.
Okay. All right. But yeah, lots of immediate things that a lot of people in Hawaii are concerned about. Gosh, well, so you've got these town hall meetings and then you're back in D.C.?
Yeah, go right back into it and right back into the appropriations process because our appropriations committee is trying to finish up the current fiscal year, which we're you know, 5 months late on at this point. And that's a critical issue because if we don't get that finished by March 14th, then we face another government shutdown. And this is not something that should happen at all. We should be able to reach this this agreement. I'm pretty optimistic we'll get there. I don't want to go, you know, nobody wants to go through a government shutdown in the middle of all of this confusion and chaos. But it will take bipartisan doing because the basics are that although the president is the president and there's Republican majorities technically in both houses of Congress, you have to do these big bills on a bipartisan basis.
Right. So you need to reach across the aisle. All right. Well, Congressman, thank you so much for your time. I know you're very busy, but we appreciate you stopping by today.
Thanks so much. Case.house.gov for any further information.
Okay. All right. We've been hearing from Congressman Ed Case, who's live in our studio this morning. Again, he's back home and will be hosting a number of town hall meetings this week. Stay tuned for the latest on the White House executive orders. This week, we're hearing from leaders at social service agencies as there's been a changing of the guard at a number of the key agencies. Aloha United Way CEO Michelle Bartel took over at the start of this year. We spoke with her yesterday afternoon. The concern about the order to pause federal loan and grant programs sent administrators scrambling to understand how their operations could be affected.
We've been hearing from a lot of partners that they were trying to draw down on their federal funding and the portals are closed or give them messages that, they're not available. And so we're, experiencing a lot of fear and uncertainty and confusion on the part of our nonprofit partners. And we are essentially letting them know that, we're all in this together and that we're going to do what we can to make sure they get the support that they need. Our 211 line, we're making sure that we are staffing up appropriately for that in case we experience additional calls for assistance from individuals and even nonprofits in the community. So far, so good, though. We haven't experienced an increase in calls, but we're just trying to understand the scope of this situation so that we can, respond appropriately to our partners.
Well, we had a conversation earlier with Representative Jill Takuda, who said that, her counterparts across the country, they're hearing reports from like domestic violence groups who are worried about funding and if they can keep their, shelters open. Are you hearing anything specific like that?
Well, we do have a lot of organizations that provide, services to the houseless. And of course, they are very concerned because they're quite reliant on federal funding. We want to be sure that shelters are going to be able to remain open, that they're going to be able to provide services to the folks that need it. But, nonprofits also have payroll and they have rent to pay. So, there's just such far-reaching impacts of this federal funding, and it really trickles down to a lot of folks that maybe you wouldn't immediately think would be impacted by this. For example, Head Start appears to be, if this pause is not lifted immediately, Head Start is impacted. Well, that could impact folks' ability to, have childcare so that they can go to work. Yeah, a lot of very far-reaching impacts to our local organizations and to the people in our community. We really hope that this is going to get stopped quickly. We're hoping that our congressional delegation is going to be able to advocate on Hawaii's behalf and make sure that the funding is restored as soon as possible.
Well, we are trying to understand, are there contractual issues that could prevent, the flow of money from happening? Because we were hearing, oh, no, direct assistance won't be affected. And yet, mm-hmm. we're hearing anecdotally, oh, no, yeah, people, the system's down, they can't get in. And so it is a little distressing that we don't have a good handle on what is affected and what is not.
Exactly. I mean, and a little distressing is a little bit of an understatement. It's a lot distressing. And as you can imagine, people are just really scrambling to try and figure out what exactly the scope is and who is going to be impacted, because the information is also very conflicting. And we heard initially that direct payments to individuals such as Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid were not impacted, and then we heard that Medicaid was. So it's very hard to sort through what is the true scope of the situation and who's going to be impacted.
And boy, 2025 sure is off to a rough start.
Yes. To say the least, I don't think that anyone really anticipated that it would come this swiftly. We knew that there would be changes and that there would be implications, especially for the nonprofit community. I don't know that we anticipated it to come quite so quickly. But like I said, we're, you know, Aloha United Way has been around for over 100 years. We've weathered a lot of different unprecedented situations before. And, you know, this is no different. I was on the phone with Hano, the folks over at Hano, Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations, and with Hawaii Community Foundation. I mean, we're in it together. We're here to support our nonprofits that do so much and provide so many vital services to our community. And the truth is that government is just not equipped to provide those services. I mean, this is why they provide the funding to nonprofit organizations, because they are equipped with the resources and the skill to be able to provide the services that our community needs. And, you know, but they can't do it without the funding, obviously. So our hope is that we can hopefully get these things sorted through in the courts so that we can get back to the business of really serving and helping the people of Hawaii.
Well, the need is so great. You know, I mean, we saw what happened with the wildfires and all the social service groups that, you know, jumped in to help, you know, those families that were displaced on Maui there. But, you know, it's unclear what's going to continue, right? Because I know FEMA is also a target as well. And yes. So we just worry about those families in LA and here in the islands as well.
Right. And, you know, of course, our hearts go out to them, because I feel like here in Hawaii, we can really relate to what those folks in Los Angeles are going through in a way that few communities in the country can. And for them to be experiencing the immediacy of their loss and all the things that go along with it, and now to have this uncertain cloud added on top, it's re-traumatizing for them. And I can't even imagine what they're going through. But at the same time, I do worry for our Maui families too. You know, with FEMA being questioned, our Maui folks still need a lot of support. Our community will be there for them, but we really rely on some of that federal funding as well. So we just hope that our congressional delegation is able to do what they can, and that the courts, you know, are able to block what is, from everything that we have seen, this is really, it's not legal what the administration is trying to do. So we have to hope that the system works.
Well, is there any underlying message that you have for any of these social service groups or any of the people that access their services?
Yeah, so our 211 statewide helpline is actually reaching out right now to make sure that we have very updated information on services that are available, and that we have the very latest in terms of any programs that might be impacted. So we really encourage our nonprofit partners to respond so that we can be sure we have the most accurate and updated information in our 211 database, so that when local residents call, we can be sure that we are providing them the right referrals. And also, I know this is still very early. We are keeping close tabs on the situation. We are assessing what's going on. And, you know, as a community together, I know that we will pull together to make sure that no one is going to be slipping through the cracks, that we do have our safety nets in place to be able to provide continued uninterrupted support to our community.
Well, I think this is going to play out much like the Muslim ban that President Trump tried to put in place, and that, you know, it basically was all handled in the courts. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see how this plays out as well.
That's right. And, you know, we just have to do what we can in the meantime to support each other and, you know, be flexible as we navigate what this new executive order is going to bring.
That was Michelle Bartel, CEO of Aloha United Way, who we talked to yesterday afternoon. Aloha United Way marks more than 100 years of service strengthening our community. Its 211 helpline is a lifeline for those in need. The Trump administration has made it clear where it stands with oil and green energy. Today, HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us to talk about two new developments on the energy front here in Hawaii. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what happened?
Well, it's only Wednesday, and it's already been a very busy week in terms of local energy policy. So yesterday, we got a new executive order from the governor that changes our renewable portfolio standards for neighbor islands. So the entire state was expected to move off fossil fuels by 2045. Now, Kauai, Maui County, and Hawaii County are expected to be completely off fossil fuels by 2035, so a decade ahead of schedule.
Well, interesting. So, tell us more about the progress.
So when we look at Kauai, that's often held as the gold standard for progress on our renewable goals. They're at 60% renewable, and under good conditions, they can be completely renewable for several hours a day. Big Island is at about half, so 50% of its electricity comes from renewable sources, and Maui County is at about 35%. And the folks that I've spoke to are celebrating this. They think that it's doable. What's interesting is this executive order came right on the heels of a new energy plan from the Energy Office that suggests Oahu, specifically, just Oahu, import liquefied natural gas. And that's in order to reduce our dependence on oil. And the energy plan has been over a year in the making. And I spoke with Chief Energy Officer Mark Glick about it yesterday.
We did a complete analysis that looked at every possible fuel that is available for import into Hawaii or that could be grown locally. And we reviewed that under four criteria, including technological maturity, costs, and other factors, carbon impact, for example. And the only one in the near term that could meet all of those criteria was natural gas.
So what's the reasoning then? Explain more about, what they outlined.
So Glick says that replacing oil with liquefied natural gas can have cost savings for ratepayers, reduce emissions, and make the grid more reliable. But we're talking about a huge investment, over $1 billion, to retrofit our power plants that currently run on oil. And that the plan suggests building a brand new power plant that can run on natural gas in the footprint of where the island's old coal plant sat that was demolished just a couple of years ago. And it relies on the idea that we could use this new infrastructure for something other than natural gas by 2045. So Oahu is not off the hook to be completely off fossil fuels in 20 years. So we have to transition all of that infrastructure onto something else. One suggestion is clean hydrogen, but right now that resource is extremely cost prohibitive. And this would all need to happen very quickly. We need to have the first batch of those power plants running on natural gas by 2030 in order to make this investment cost effective. So we are seeing a lot of reactions from folks as this plan has come out. Hawaiian Electric was rather lukewarm in a statement, noting that we've been down this road with liquefied natural gas before. So Governor Linda Lingle opposed it. Her successor, Neil Abercrombie, supported it. And then Governor Ige dismissed the idea a decade ago and subsequently signed into law the 100% renewable energy goals that the state has to meet by 2045, which is what Governor Green updated yesterday. And HECO says that it's this, quote, stop and start public policy loop that is part of what has put us in this difficult position with our power plants today. And even before this report was officially out, we've had wind of whisperings about liquefied natural gas for a while. Many energy stakeholders and environmentalists were challenging the supposed benefits of liquefied natural gas. And now they're pointing out specific details that they don't think add up in the state energy office's analysis. So Henry Curtis, with Life of the Land, who is deeply involved with the Public Utilities Commission, says the plan, quote, vastly oversimplifies the regulatory process. So those hurdles that we would need to go through at the PUC in order to bring these plants online. And he also says the report ignores the potential of alternatives that aren't fuel-based, like hydropower or geothermal. I also spoke with Josh Stanbro. Folks might remember him as Honolulu City and County's first chief resilience officer, and I got his reaction on both the executive order and the Energy Office's fuel analysis.
You've got an executive order coming from the governor's office that supports where we want to go, which is making sure that every single home and family has energy security and sovereignty with solar on their roof and battery backup and protection against extreme weather and getting us to 100% renewable goal. And then you have a study coming out of the staff of the energy office, which explores a different possibility. But I'm hopeful that the executive order is the governor's state policy and that the study is sort of a thought exercise by some staff in the state energy office. And it isn't a statement of the governor's policy or where, you know, the state is going.
And Stanford told me he thinks that the energy office's analysis, quote, puts a thumb on the scale for LNG.
If you look at the analysis, it relies on really optimistic assumptions, but it overlooks really key risks. And those key risks are LNG price volatility, the you know, with methane, you've got a ton of emissions that are not calculated in the study in terms of leakage and other things. And then there's $2 billion in infrastructure costs. And the timeline is super aggressive, too. I mean, they are looking at a very rose-colored glasses scenario on building out $2 billion worth of infrastructure over a very short period. And I think we've seen a history of large infrastructure projects, not just in Hawaii, but anywhere, taking much longer than expected and coming at a much higher bill than expected. So I think between the sort of the rose-colored glasses around pricing volatility and then the ability and speed which with infrastructure can be built out, neither of those historically on the ground seem to match what the study is assuming in their model.
So he's saying too optimistic, but at the same time, you're trying to be pragmatic. It is cleaner than oil, and if the idea is that the infrastructure is going to be used for hydrogen, but we didn't get that big grant that the governor was hoping to be a part of for hydrogen development. So it's a tough place to be in.
It is, and I think folks feel like it might be a distraction from progress we're making on other renewable resources. I also spoke to Evan Weber, who lives on Oahu, and he's one of the co-founders of the Sunrise Movement on climate action and environmental justice issues. And he was really encouraged by the executive order that came out on the governor from the governor's office and says that's exactly what we need to focus on. But he said the energy office's report put a fossil fuel stained mark on what would have been an otherwise laudable action. I'm quoting him there. And he says that when we think about natural gas infrastructure, that investment would not only keep our grid, Oahu's grid, tied to fossil fuels, it also means communities where those plants are put will have to continue to deal with fossil fuels. And keep in mind, the plan suggests that building a new power plant where Oahu's last coal plant just sat a few years ago.
West Oahu communities have already faced the biggest, most significant burden of our reliance on fossil fuels. We have a lot of power plants based out there that have caused pollution and health issues. The Waianae Coast has some of the highest rates of asthma in the islands. And so retiring that coal plant was a really big win for the communities out in West Oahu. They've also been struggling with renewable energy projects that have come in and haven't really worked well to make sure that there would be benefits to the communities that would be served in that area. Kapolei, West Oahu, the Waianae Coast, Waianae Moku, they deserve better than what we've been given them on energy solutions so far. And to just stick another polluting fossil fuel plant that, albeit would be cleaner than coal, but still would have health impacts, I just think that it's really a disservice to these communities that have already borne the brunt of our reliance on fossil fuels.
All right. Well, we'll just have to see how this plays out. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been hearing from HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Honolulu Waldorf School, Learn more about activities middle schoolers experience at a middle school open house this afternoon. Registration at honoluluwaldorf.org.
HPR celebrates the life of our former president and general manager, Jose Fajardo. Join me, DJ Mermaid, for a Bridging the Gap throwback from December 2020 when Jose guest hosted with me. Our DJ El Presidente took us on an epic journey through his eclectic music picks. Join us for this special presentation of Bridging the Gap this Saturday night at 6 on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Alan Bromley, At the Edge of Forever, mixed-media print-based works that explore themes such as memory, loss, and the environment. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This week's Mono Minute is a showstopper. Enter the peacock. You'll easily recognize these magnificent birds on sight. But are you familiar with their song? We've got that for you today, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Here's your Mono Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo professor Patrick Hart.
Male Indian peafowls, or peacocks, are among the most recognizable birds in the world. Native to southern India and Sri Lanka, they were first brought to Hawaii in the mid-1800s, and peacocks and peahens have now become established on all the main Hawaiian islands. They can live in a variety of habitats, including neighborhoods, parks, and woodlands, and with their omnivorous diet, eat a range of foods, including fruits, grains, insects, and even small vertebrates like lizards and koki frogs. In addition to being so visually unique, the songs of peacocks are also very distinctive. Many people in Hawaii have heard their song, even if they may not know it was a peacock making it. The reason why peacocks have such massive, iridescent, and beautiful tails has been a source of wonder for centuries. We usually assume that most characteristics of animals have evolved to make them better adapted to surviving in their environment. But how could such a large, showy tail improve a peacock's chance of survival? Even Charles Darwin, after publishing his theory of natural selection, famously said that looking at a peacock's tail made him sick because natural selection could not explain it. This over time led him to propose a second theory known as sexual selection, which is now widely accepted, and holds that showy ornaments on animals, such as the peacock's tail, have evolved through selection by females. In other words, females choose those males with the largest, prettiest tails, and those are the ones that pass on their genes to the next generation, while the males with the less showy tails may get no matings at all. This often happens in mating arenas known as leks, where multiple males all come together in a group competition to show off their tail ornaments to choosy females. Over time, the tails evolve to be showier and showier because that's what the females want. Peacocks are known as pikake in Hawaiian, and they have an important connection with Hawaiian royalty. Kaʻiulani was so taken by the birds, she became known as the Peacock Princess. When a new sweet-scented species of jasmine flower was imported to Hawaii, Kaʻiulani fell in love with that as well and named it after her favorite bird. Pikake are still one of the most common flowers for lei across the islands, and it's said that the night Kaʻiulani died in 1899 at the age of 23, her peacocks screamed so loud they could be heard for miles away. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
Football. softball players at Kalani Roosevelt and St. Louis High Schools may be noticing some changes to their training programs. They've been part of a University of Hawaii study called HUT 808, which aims to reduce concussions by training football athletes to tackle like rugby players. Troy Furutani is the program manager for the Hawaii Concussion Management Awareness Program at UH Manoa. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the HUT 808 study.
Well, football is, I like to think it's part of the culture here in Hawaii. The children will play flag football or tackle football growing up, especially with some of the success some individuals had in college and in the professional level. I think, and also too with a lot of the major colleges coming here to recruit, I think football has become a popular sport in high schools. You know, so with that comes the risk of injury, not just concussions, but all other types of injuries. So, like, my profession is in athletic training, so one of our major domains that we try to focus on is injury prevention. So with this HUT 808 program, it looks into how can we lower the head impact exposures during football at all positions also too.
And the origin story of it is pretty interesting too, that there was a local figure involved in mm-hmm. its founding. So tell us a little more about that.
So there's a lawyer, Gary Gallagher. He represented a few players who had passed away from CTE, so he represented their families. And he was looking for a panel of experts to help with the case. You know, he came across Dr. Schwartz, and he also reached out to H-Camp at that time also, too. He put on this conference called the Neuro Huddle. The first one was at the University of Hawaii, right on the basement of Stan Sheriff Center. And then after his passing, he had a foundation created, and that foundation reached out to Dr. Schwartz because they're very interested in his technique of tackling and his whole curriculum and his philosophy with that. Because Gary Gallagher was here in Hawaii, I guess they wanted to pair it, bring it back to Hawaii to run it here. So the whole style of tackling is modeled after rugby. Rugby players don't wear helmets, so they have to naturally keep their head out of the way. So the whole philosophy behind the HUT 808 tackling curriculum is that the athletes will do a series of tackling drills for, I think it's about 12 weeks. So they run it, you know, preseason throughout the season to maintain the skills that they learn. But then when they do the drills, they'll take off their helmets and their shoulder pads, and then they'll run these drills with the idea that the helmet is like a protective mechanism for them, kind of like wearing a seatbelt. So if you have that helmet on, they may tend to be more risky. They may tend to use that as a point of impact or not really focusing on their technique, but just putting their head in the way of the tackle. But if you take the helmet away and the shoulder pads away, that behavior will change because they don't have that protective mechanism. And then when they do go into practice all these drills, the hope is that that technique will transfer into their play.
Yeah. And so what does each phase of this study project look like, and what point are you at right now?
At first, it was a three-year study, but then with COVID, then the sporting season got pretty much canceled, so we extended it to 4 years, so we could still continue the project on that way. We involved three schools, actually three football teams, JV and varsity. The first year was pretty much just letting them do what they normally do, and then they would collect the amount of impacts that happened, the location of the impacts, and then we would, then the following year, we would do this intervention, which is the HUT tackling technique. And the way we would collect the data is that we provided the teams with helmets with sensors in them, and then that would provide us the magnitude, the location, as well as the frequency, how many impacts were they having during practices and games and such. Yeah. The schools that were involved with St. Louis, Roosevelt, and then Kalani.
And thinking about the results, so you're in the analysis phase. I've seen a couple studies already come out, but any high-level takeaways in terms of, you know, does this intervention actually work?
Yeah, so we did, one was done that looked at position, so that was something unique. You know, we always think that linemen would have the most amount of impacts and things like that because every play they would be making contact, but we found that skilled positions had the higher magnitude. The other one that we found is that the amount of impacts that were happening happened in the second and fourth quarters. But then another interesting finding was that a lot more impacts and the magnitude of the impact was greater during warm-ups.
You don't think of that necessarily. You don't think of that as part of the game even. So that shines a light on an interesting spot.
Yeah, interesting spot. So maybe that information could potentially be used to help coaches determine what they're doing during warm-ups and things like that to reduce the impact load.
But in terms of looking at whether the rugby-style tackling led to fewer concussions, do you have evidence
We don't have that evidence yet. Oh, I think we're going to be looking into that. That takes a lot more, I think, data digging and things. So that's something I think we'll be looking into.
Any other future questions that you're hoping to explore with that data?
So this project has been done at the collegiate level, and then now it's been done at the high school level. I think we want to take it down to the youth level. For me personally, I think that'll have a greater impact because it'll teach them the proper technique, and then they can take that on as they develop throughout their playing career. Yeah.
Are there any general pieces of advice you give for people trying to prevent against concussions and reduce the risk of that happening when they play football?
Well, for coaches, our message always is to be able to recognize a concussion and then know what to do. So you should pull them out, and then they need to, get a medical clearance. There is a Hawaii concussion law. Every state in the United States has a concussion law, and there's three main components to those laws. One is annual concussion education and awareness for coaches, parents, athletes. The other one is mandatory removal from play when a concussion is suspected. So you don't have to know that there's a concussion, but if you suspect one, they should be removed. And then routine medical clearance from a licensed healthcare provider before they can go back to participation. So we have that law. So we try to reinforce that to the coaches. And also, too, we try to give coaches some strategies as far as, creating a safe reporting environment. So players will feel safe, they don't feel like threatened that they'll lose their starting position or things like that if they do report their concussion. We try to talk about how to minimize the amount of impacts. USA Football has a chart that looks at different ways to practice sessions and how you can lower the amount of impacts during football. But then, it's not just during football too. We try to educate soccer coaches, baseball, basketball. So we always try to provide all that information to those coaches. And then for parents, it's, again, being able to recognize a concussion and then also to being an advocate for their concussed child, know what to do. What are the resources out there when they do see their doctor? What information they should provide to the doctor? And also, too, what's also very important is that if their child does have a concussion, that they communicate that with the school so the school knows. Mm-hmm. And then I guess for the student athletes, the main thing is that we say take it seriously and then to take care of their teammates.
That was Troy Furutani from the Concussion Management Awareness Program. He spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about the HUT 808 study, which has been playing out across three high school football programs on Oahu for the past 4 years. Look for links to their study findings on our website after the show. Well, we've got to go now, but up tomorrow we consider our eyesight and dive deep into a medical mystery causing vision loss. Why are there so many cases on the Big Island? Got feedback for us? Record something on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Happy Lunar New Year, everybody. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.